Yeah, so in the past couple lectures, we talked about how to sort of split space-time into sort of time and space, and we decompose the Einstein equations according to that space-time decomposition. We talked about how we can think of the Einstein equations as sort of imposing some constraints on some initial hypersurface and then telling you how to evolve forward in time. And then I guess in the last lecture, Louise Lehner talked about what it means for an evolution system to be well posed. So today we're going to take a little detour from talking about evolution equations to go back and talk about these constraint equations and how, in particular, you would go about solving them. That is, constructing initial data for ultimately for volume. Choosing that initial data such that it solves the kind of part of the Einstein equations. Yeah. Again, if you're interested in a reference for this, these same lecture notes on the 3+1 decomposition, in particular, chapter 8 covers this topic about initial data. So there are, in general, sort of many different approaches to tackling this initial data problem, and it's very much an ongoing topic of research. But in this lecture, I'm going to give sort of one example of a formulation for constructing solutions, and then I'll mention maybe some of the other ones at the very end. So. When we're constructing initial data, we sort of have two goals that are somewhat at odds. So the first one is that we want to choose a three-metric and extrinsic curvature such that it satisfies our constraint equations. So just to remind you what those are. This is the Hamiltonian constraint. So that's the energy density, extrinsic curvature, that's the spatial Ricci curvature. I think you can just leave them, I think we're good. Yeah, it's fine. Yeah. And then our second constraint equation is the momentum constraint. Where this is the momentum density. Okay, so we got to satisfy these equations if we're going to say we have a solution to the Einstein equations. But we have a second goal, and that is that we want to choose these quantities just so they actually, you know, correspond to the physical system we're interested in. You know, if we're interested in considering a binary black hole where, you know, one black hole is 10 solar masses, the other one is 15 solar masses, and one is spinning or something, we want to, you know, choose this initial data to correspond as closely as possible to that system we're interested in. And so, you know, these goals are somewhat, it's fine, yeah, we're good, thanks. These goals are somewhat at odds in the sense that, we can't just whatever values you want, they have to satisfy these equations. So the sort of strategy is going to be we're going to divide our degrees of freedom into sort of two categories. And we're going to call these the free data. So those are going to be the things that we just choose based on what we're, our physical system are interested in. And then the other one is going to be called the constrained data. And the constrained data is going to be the ones that we don't specify, that we construct by solving these equations, basically.
But all of this are, say, one particular time slice, right? It's where computing. What we want is just the, say, some initial data.
Yeah. So, yeah, as we discussed before, like, all we need is that the constraint equations are satisfied at some initial time slice, and then our evolution equations will guarantee that at a later time they'll still be satisfied as long as we use the, you know, the evolution equations that the Einstein equations give us, right? So the challenge here is that we both want to have as much control over our data in like a physically reasonable way by choosing this free data, but we also want to give rise, like, we want to, when we rewrite these constraint equations in terms of the free and constrained data, we want to give rise to some well-posed equations that will be guaranteed to, or basically that we can solve and be confident that there will be a solution to. So in particular, we don't want to do things like, just choose, one metric component and then let the other one be free or something like that. So first of all, let's just count the degrees of freedom we have. So from our constraint equations, we basically have 4 degrees of freedom, right? We have Hamiltonian is one scalar equation, and this is gives you 3 equations because it's a spatial vector equation. And does anyone want to tell me how many degrees of freedom we have in choosing gamma ij and kij?
Both of them are symmetric, so 6 plus 6.
Yes, exactly. They're both symmetric, so they both have 6 components. So that's a total of 12. And so that means, just by subtraction here, that means we need to specify 8 degrees of freedom. And then also matter, if we have matter in our system. So the sort of common strategy, which is the one we'll go over today, is to use a conformal decomposition of the metric. Basically, we're going to specify various quantities up to some conformal factor, and then we'll solve the constrained equations to get this conformal factor. This kind of has a nice interpretation that, this conformal factor were 1, then we basically get out what we put in. But if what we specify is not exactly a solution of the constraint equations without some conformal rescaling, we can figure what that is.
So this 8 degrees of freedom would be our free data.
Exactly, yeah. Okay, so we're going to sort of need some various formula based on conformal transformations. I'm just gonna write those down. So yeah, first just to recall what I mean by a conformal transformation. You know, just for a general n-dimensional metric. Where we introduce this omega squared factor that's just some scalar that rescales our metric. So if we have that, we can write down a couple different formula. So if you're thinking, if you want a reference for these, you can also find them in an appendix in Carroll's spacetime. So the first one is the let's just consider how the covariant derivative acting on a scalar changes. We instead construct these quantities with respect to the conformal metric instead of the actual metric. So in this case, we basically get no change because this just corresponds to the ordinary derivative. It doesn't really depend on which one you use. But that changes if we go to considering the derivative of a vector. So these are all the extra terms you pick up going from the one with respect to the ordinary metric to the conformal one. And you can also write down the difference in the Christoffel symbols between the ones calculated with the regular metric and the conformal metric. So I'm going to use this tensor C, or this symbol C to describe the difference in the two Christoffel symbols. That's its definition. And we get this. And finally, we want the relationship between the two different Ricci curvatures. So how that changes under our conformal rescaling. All right. So a little bit long. So these are all, these hold in sort of in general for some n-dimensional metric, but sort of from here on out, we're going to specialize to n equals 3 because we're interested in just the spatial geometry.
So in that, everything is tilde, right? Did you miss a tilde in that omega inverse? Just...
Yeah.
And thanks. The way we would go about computing these things is just substituting g, wherever we find g, we substitute omega square g tilde. And means I was...
Yeah, you basically just have to plug in for this, plug in this, and then work out how all the partial derivatives, but they sort of act on this and give you extra terms. Yeah, and that's where all these guys are going to come from.
I see, okay.
Yeah. So that, I mean, it's a bit tedious, we're not going to do that.
Yeah.
But that's the general idea. All right. And so we're going to work out what's called the conformal transverse traceless decomposition. All right, so first the conformal part. So we're going to take our spatial metric gamma ij, and now we're actually, instead of using this squared factor, we're going to write it as a fourth power. We'll see what that is for why we do that in a second. So that's the relation between conformal metric and the full metric. And we're going to end up, this is going to be our sort of free data, or one of them. And this is going to be the constrained data, conformal factor. So if we just plug that in there, letting letting psi squared be equal to omega and letting n equals 3, then we get the following for the Ricci, three-dimensional Ricci scalar. All right, and so we can notice if we stare at this for a second that this term and this term are actually going to cancel out, right? We get a 4, 8 plus 8, and then we get a minus 8 here, and the power is minus 6, and minus 8 plus 2 cancel out. So we can simplify that. And just get that. And that's kind of why we chose this to make our life a bit easier. Right, so that's the decomposition of the spatial metric. We are also going to want to decompose the extrinsic curvature, which is the other thing we need to solve for. All right, so continuing to explain this name, we're now decomposing the extrinsic curvature into a traceless part, and then this is its trace. So we notice we just take the trace of both sides, these two terms will cancel, so this has to be traceless. And you know, this is also going to be some free data. And then we're also going to conformally rescale this traceless part. This is the definition of a hat. And the reason for choosing this magic number of minus 10 will hopefully become clear in a few lines.
So the trace part is k into, that should be something like a delta function, right? What is that?
I mean, it's a gamma ij. I mean, if you lower one indice, then it will be a delta. Yeah. Yeah. So if you just take take the lower gamma ij, contract to this side, you just get k. This side, you're going to get exactly. Okay, any other questions about that? All right, so in terms of these new variables, we can rewrite our Hamiltonian constraint.
We still have, they're choosing free data was like 6 degrees of freedom in choosing gamma tilde, and this is the seventh one, k.
Yeah, we're not done yet. We haven't talked about the transverse part yet. Yeah, so we're kind of done with the Hamiltonian constraint, but we still are gonna further decompose this guy. So yeah, I mean, if we want to keep track, we've got kind of 5 degrees of freedom here, right? Went from 6 here, and then we from 1 to 5. And then now we're choosing another one here, but then we're gonna have to choose some more degrees of freedom here. All right. Yeah, so just to rewrite our Hamiltonian constraint. So this is sort of, you know, and again, just to emphasize, you know, all these quantities here are calculated with respect to the conformal spatial metric, including this like Ricci scalar and these derivatives. So this is beginning to look something like a elliptic equation, right? Sort of the, you know, like a Laplace equation, right? We have a Laplace operator, but now with respect to a conformal metric acting on this, and that's the highest derivative term. But we still need to do some more work before we have the momentum constraint in the form we want. So the first term in the momentum constraint is as this. And using that decomposition, I can write it this way. And now using this this expression here, the difference in Christoffel symbols, I can write this as just the difference between these two, we get these extra terms instead of the Christoffel symbols, you know, the difference in the Christoffel symbols between the metric and the conformal metric. So if we plug in that expression, we get the following. Tell me why I can ignore that term.
It's traceless.
Yeah, exactly. We're taking the trace of the traceless, that's zero. And now plugging in we can just combine these two terms to get this. And now we see where this magic minus 10 comes from. Because we can just rewrite this. In terms of the a hat. Okay. And this means sort of so far momentum constraint looks like the following. Quite done yet. I haven't told you about the transverse decomposition yet. We still need to do a little more work on this to get it sort of in the form of a vector Laplace type equation. And we still need to pick some more free data. So we're going to further decompose this A hat. And we're going to basically decompose it into a longitudinal part and a transverse part. So, right, this needs some explanation. So first of all, this part here, I put the subscript TT, that stands for transverse baseless. So this is going to be, again, traceless by construction, and we can kind of think of this decomposition. So I'll explain what this L tilde means in a second. Basically, I think of this as the longitudinal part. And this is the transverse part of this A hat.
So even the longitudinal part now becomes traceless.
Yeah, so this is traceless, this is traceless, so that has to be traceless too. Right? So TT here means that, so this is the transverse part, that this is zero, and we're also requiring that its trace be zero. So that's what TT means. And then XI is going to be a vector that we're going to solve for. And this L tilde is called the conformal Killing operator. Let me define that. So this extra term is basically guarantees that we're traceless again, right? Because if we take the trace of both sides, then basically these two terms will cancel out with that one, right? So yeah, again, this is traceless just as we need it to be, so that kind of all three of these terms are traceless.
How do we get that one? The transitivity equation got confused.
This one?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just asserting that this is true. This is kind of my definition. We'll come back to that in a second. But yeah, I haven't derived this. I'm basically just requiring this. Also, I call this here the conformal Killing operator. So can anyone tell me, if we just, ignore the tildes here, can anyone tell me why a Killing vector would satisfy that this equation is equal to zero?
I think the way we did it is this is exactly the equation for the conformal Killing vector.
Yeah, so the Killing vector, we just have these two things, right?
Yeah.
And so, and this is basically just taking that equation and subtracting out the trace. So if this thing is zero and then you take out its trace, it's still zero, right?
Okay, any Killing vector will satisfy that.
Yeah, so any Killing vector. That kind of justifies the name. right? And so I'm just kind of asserting that we can do this. So it's basically a mathematical statement that if you're sort of asymptotically flat or in a closed manifold, then you can do this decomposition. If you're interested in the details of that, that's like an appendix B of the lecture notes I put up there, the Corgignon ones. But basically now, after introducing these concepts, we're ready to define the conformal vector Laplacian. So that's going to be represented with this delta. And it's basically just taking the conformal derivative of this thing. That's kind of the divergence of that. And by this property, we can see that, you know, if we just apply this e tilde j that, then we just get a hat, right? Because this is zero by this requirement. Okay, so now we're basically ready to rewrite our momentum constraint. So we take that one right there and plug in this. And I'm going to go ahead and write down the Hamiltonian constraint too, using these variables. All right, so you noticed here I snuck in some tildes over the momentum density and the energy density. But I haven't sort of specified what those scalings are going to be, right? I just put in a conformal rescaling to the nth power here for the energy density and to the nth power here for the momentum density. So now we want to sort of think about what would be the best choice for these m and n's for the case that we do have matter. So first of all, we can sort of look at the the Hamiltonian constraint, or sorry, let's look at the momentum constraint here, right? And let's say we're going to choose this extrinsic, the trace of the extrinsic curvature as one of our free data, right? So if we make the choice that k is constant, so that's called a constant mean curvature slicing sometimes. So if we make that choice, then this term will disappear, right? And if we basically choose this m to be 10, then we can also ignore this term. And so if we do both those things, then actually the dependence on the conformal factor psi drops out of the momentum constraint. So we can actually just solve that this equals zero first, and then once we have some solution, then we can plug it in here and then try to solve the Hamiltonian constraint. So the equations.
There, if you put m is equal to 10, we would solve the vector Laplacian equal to 8 pi, means equal to 8 pi rho. It's not, means it's still a source term is still there, right? Because pi, 8 pi pi tilde will still be there, right?
Yes, sorry, that's right. We'll just have this equals this, yeah. Yeah, the point is that the equation won't depend on psi, yeah.
So that and put it here.
Yeah, and you know, furthermore, if you just have this equals some source function here, actually show that you have sort of the existence and uniqueness for like asymptotically flat manifolds. All right, and oh yeah, just a little bit more of terminology. A special case where you choose this trace of the extrinsic curvature to be zero, that's called maximal slicing. All right, so now we just have to think about how we're going to choose this n here. So first of all, let's kind of consider the uniqueness of the Hamiltonian constraint, or in particular, sort of the local uniqueness. So let's say that we have some solution I bar, and then we want to consider adding some small perturbation at solution psi bar, and then require psi to also be a solution. And epsilon to be small in some sense. So basically, we're just going to take the Hamiltonian constraint and just keep all the terms that are leading order or linear in epsilon. And then we're going to use the fact that psi bar already, they're basically these both solve the Hamiltonian constraint to get a formula for epsilon. So we get something like this, our Laplace equation here, and then some function here, which I'll call C times epsilon. So if you sort of recall from your PDE's class, you have such a harmonic function or plus some extra function here, then if we require C to be greater than or equal to zero, then we have a maximum principle. What that means is that, say we specify some boundary conditions for epsilon. So we have some domain that we're trying to solve in, and then we're specifying boundary conditions on the boundary of that domain, then the maximum principle basically states if this C is greater than or equal to zero, then that epsilon will only obtain its maximum, basically it'll always obtain its maximum on the boundary. And if it attains its maximum in the interior, that means the function is in fact constant.
Something like that. So here what we're trying to do is that we're checking when Hamiltonian constant will be stable or something. How is what are we trying to do here?
Yeah, so we're not quite done with the argument, but basically we want to show that this epsilon is zero. Because that'll mean that we have some solution and there's no sort of non-trivial solution nearby it. If there were two solutions nearby, that would violate this local uniqueness. Yeah, and so just to complete that argument, basically all we need to do is say if psi and psi bar satisfy the same boundary conditions, that means the boundary condition for epsilon is that epsilon equals zero. And if we apply the maximum principle to both epsilon and minus epsilon, that means that basically we're guaranteed that epsilon has to be zero throughout the whole domain. But that's only true if this quantity they call C is greater than or equal to zero. So basically, these are free data we can choose, but in particular, the one we might be worried about is this energy density, right? So we'll make that positive, but if we don't choose the right scaling for it, then this quantity could be negative, right? So in particular, we're gonna wanna choose the n is greater than or equal to 5. So it won't ruin that local uniqueness. So we don't have to choose it to be exactly 5. One common choice is actually n equals 8. And so that actually comes from the following considerations. So basically, we want to require that if our, you know, if we specify some conformal energy density, momentum density that satisfies energy condition, then you know, once we solve for the conformal factor, which we don't get to specify, we have to solve for, and we don't want the energy density and momentum density we get back out to violate that energy constraint. So we consider the dominant energy condition. In 3 plus 1 form, that just basically states that that have to be that this combination of the energy density and momentum density has to be less than or equal to 0. So you can kind of see that this all the dominant energy, because this term, take it to the right-hand side, has to dominate over the momentum density. So that's kind of equivalent to requiring this this quantity to be a future pointing causal vector. So if we work this out in terms of our conformal quantities, we get that if we start with conformal quantities that satisfy this, and then we calculate what the rescale quantities are, we get that so plugging in this n equals 8, we get a minus 16 here. Can everyone see that, by the way? No. Let me write over here.
I lost the track. Yeah. You said that n is equal to 8 is some choice, and that n is equal to 8, how is it connected to the dominant energy condition?
Yeah, we're just about to get that. Sorry, I was going to move over here so everyone can see it. Yeah, so basically we want to guarantee that if we choose these conformal quantities, such that they satisfy like a kind of conformal dominant energy condition, we want to show that this implies that once we rescale things, then we'll still have this. So let's just work through what happens with our rescaling. Sorry, with a non. And then we just get that. We can kind of see we get what is it? we get 10 for both of these. So that's minus 20, and we get 4 for this guy. So that's adds up to minus 16. So that shows that this follows from that. Okay, so just kind of to recap, our conformal transverse traceless decomposition. All right. So does everyone remember what all the free data are?
It's gamma tilde ij. K.
Yep.
And free parameters were M and N, right? Then.
Well, those are just constants we're choosing.
I thought means this gives 6, and we need 2 more. I thought.
Yeah, we need 2 more, and so those are, this, the transverse traceless. Parts of this. So yeah. So this one has 5 because it's like the we sort of took away 1 degree of freedom by specifying the conformal factor. This is 1 and this is 2 here. So it adds up to the 8 we need. And then if you have matter, we also specify the matter as free data. And the data we have to solve for, it's just the conformal factor psi and this vector xi. So again, that adds up to 4. We have 4 constraint equations. And once we specify these, solve our 2 equations for these, then we can calculate everything. Rescale our conformal metric, a nice our extrinsic curvature, and it has the base piece which we specify, and has the transverse traceless piece we also specify. And then the piece that we have to solve for. And then we can also obtain, if we have matter, we can just obtain that. I think we're about out of time. So next class, I'll sort of give a simple example of solving this equation, and then maybe mention briefly some other ways to decompose the initial data problem. So they're kind of all in spirit similar to this, based on usually conformal decompositions and so on, but they make slightly different choices on what the free data is, what the constrained data is. Okay, so any questions about that before we break?
In that site where we were comparing that e tilde square will give e square. So we had psi 16, then, but how do we raise the lower p tildes? Is that by using gamma tilde? Or it's just using gamma?
Yeah, so like here when you specify this, you don't know what the conformal factor is. So yeah, this is specified with respect to the conformal metric. So so basically write it like right, and then we'll take 4 here and then minus 10 and minus 10 here. That's how I divide up the 16.
So what means my confusion was the P tildes and E tildes we didn't define with respect to metric or anything. We just redefined by the scale. So the raising and lowering, how do we decide whether it will be raised and lowered with respect to gamma tilde or just gamma? The P.
So I think, again, in all these equations I wrote, at least I tried to explicitly write this thing if you're using it. And otherwise, you're just manipulating everything with the conformal metric. OK, any other questions?